You are listening to a Poetry Night podcast.
Hi, this is Sarah Morgan. You're listening to the Poetry Night podcast.
Hi, you're listening to the Poetry Night podcast yet again. Our guest this week is Sarah Morgan, who is touring out of Chicago, originally from Philadelphia, and restarted the Philadelphia Slam team, which apparently had been defunct for 12 years?
Yes.
12 years. She's got a new book called Animal Ballistics that's coming out through Derek Brown's Right Bloody Press, and has been published in a number of things, including Mad Swirl, The Common Line Project, and Word Riot. She likes dogs and cats and bunnies. Also cupcakes and tasty cakes, apparently. Welcome to the show. Let's talk about tasty cakes. Why tasty cakes? What are tasty cakes?
Okay.
I've seen a tasty cake.
Tasty cakes are, I think they're specific to a certain region. I know they're very popular in the state of Pennsylvania. And when I was living in Philadelphia, I made a friend there named Jim, and he really liked tasty cakes, and I said, hey, what's a tasty cake? Because I had never heard of it, because I grew up in Connecticut. And one night, we went to Wawa, which is also a Pennsylvania thing, and we bought about 20 of them, and that was it. It was love at first tasty cake. They're just little delicious treats.
Kind of like an Eskimo pie or a moon pie or something?
Kind of like that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
okay. Well, so you're in. Let's talk about the Philadelphia Slam a little bit. That had been defunct for 12 years. How did you get involved in restarting that? When did you just sort of wander in, or?
It was a great process. I moved to Philadelphia from Connecticut, and I wasn't even really aware that people were doing writing poetry and doing spoken word in the here and now. I thought poetry was like an old thing, and it was Bukowski and Kerouac and Robert Frost, and I didn't know any new poets. And I went and I saw a show, a concert, the Cold War Kids, and Derek Brown was opening up for them, and he was reading his poetry. And that sparked an interest in me. I'm like, people are still doing this. So I went on the computer, the lovely internet, and I'm like, okay, what's going on in Philadelphia? And there was really, like, nothing. There was this one link to a slam that was on and off and on and off. So I contacted a guy named Sherrod, who was trying
to... Oh, Danny Sherrod?
No, Sherrod.
Oh, that was his first
name. Yeah, that's his first name. And he was trying to get it started back up, and it was just going in and out, and we kind of just joined forces and really promoted it. And we got together a team, and they went to nationals for the first time in like 12 years, and it just grew from there. And, you know, I've gone to Philadelphia now on the tour, and it's doing great. It's great to see.
And so that was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Closer, like, between 2 and 3.
Okay. What took you out of Philadelphia then?
I feel like Philadelphia helped me a lot in getting me immersed in the scene, and I feel like I contributed to Philadelphia, but I also felt like it was time to move on and see what else I could find as far as in the realm of writing and what other places had to offer. And I knew a lot of great things were going on in Chicago, and so I really just took a leap of faith and got in my car and drove there with nowhere to live, no job, and I'm like, this is gonna work out. And it was an excellent choice.
Are you involved in the slam community in Chicago then?
Yes. And it's fabulous. I mean, the Green Mill is where it all started. So I've been, and there's just such a great community there too, especially for the women writers. So,
what do you do in Chicago other than poetry? You mostly, are you a full-time writer these days, or?
Yeah, I mean, I picked up like a little Joe job, an office to help pay my bills for a while over the winter, but I mostly took up most of my time in Chicago. Not the Joe job, the writing community. Like I help put on a show called The Encyclopedia Show that was started by Robbie Q. Telfer and Shani Jean Magnuson. I hope I said her last name right. It's difficult. And it's a great show in Chicago where they take a bunch of artists, not just poets, but like musicians and visual artists, and we put on a show once a month. So I've been really active in that. And then in Young Chicago Authors, which is a program for the younger writers in Chicago, I've been active in that. And there's just so much there. It's a good place to keep busy.
We were talking a little bit in the car on the way over to the recording studio here. And you said your family doesn't live in Connecticut anymore. Had they been in Connecticut for a while, and then they've just sort of all left since then, or...
Did they
just sort of move into Connecticut and then move out when they were done with it?
Well, I don't know. I think my mom one day was just like, hey, I don't want to be here anymore. So she went to Florida for the warm weather, I guess. I don't really like Florida. So she went down there, and I don't know, everyone just kind of went in their own way. My sister went to Boston, and I don't know. I don't think any of us really had, like, any deeply rooted ties to Connecticut. I think we all kind of have the desire to explore, I guess.
Were you writing before you ran into Derek Brown at the in Philadelphia, or did that sort of mark your entrance into the poetry community?
I mean, on and off forever. I think, like, the first poetry book I ever kept was at the age of 7. I actually still have it. So I've been always writing, but it had died down a bit in the few years preceding up to when I met Derek. And I had never, while I did write for a while, I never had performed my stuff. That was the mark of where I started actually reading to people, audiences, and...
Do you think of what you're writing in terms of publication, or do you think of what you're writing in terms of performance?
Oh, that's good. I try to think of it in terms of publication, but as I've started performing more, I realize that when I'm writing, I'm like, well, how will this sound to the ear? And I guess I aim more for how things will look on a page. That's what I want. But I have, the more I perform, the more I do consider, you know, what will this sound like coming out of my mouth.
So, it sounds like you, when you're writing, it's mostly a visual approach to writing, and then when you're polishing it, when you're reworking a piece or whatever, then you start to incorporate more of the performance aspects of it?
Yeah.
How does that work for you? Do you resent having to perform it, or is the performance aspect a fairly significant part of the whole rewriting process? I guess what I'm asking is, would you be comfortable not doing performance if you consistently produce stuff?
I think it's important for me to perform, and I'm not always like the most comfortable performer. But I think it really, it makes me feel like I'm actively sharing my work. Whereas, you know, if someone buys a book and goes home and reads it and enjoys it, you know, obviously that makes me very happy. But when I can actually, you know, get up in front of people and say, here, have this, it's more intimate, I think. And I like doing that. I don't resent it. There are some pieces, like, if someone were to ask me, I would tell someone, you know, you can take any poem and read it to an audience. But with my own work, I'll be like, no, I can't read that to them.
Content-wise,
yeah. So I'm kind of a hypocrite like that. I don't listen to what I would suggest for other people.
Well, if it's stuff that you're uncomfortable reading to people, is it stuff that you'd be comfortable putting in a book then?
Yeah.
Because there's not the face-to-face reaction.
Yeah, and it's not that like I'm, you know, ashamed or embarrassed of the content. I just think some things are harder to listen to, I guess.
Can you give me some examples?
Okay, yeah. I had a lover who passed away, and I have a few pieces I've written for him, and when I've read them, it's felt almost too personal to take to an audience, and I feel like the room has just been, I've read them and the room has just like deflated. And it's things like that. I feel like you have to be kind of, for myself, I have to be careful in what I choose. Sometimes it's just, I think, too much to put on the ears. Maybe it's easier to just put it on the eyes, I guess.
Because on the eyes, at least you have the luxury sort of putting it down and going away and then coming back.
Yeah.
And you can give yourself a break from the emotional drain of it. Is that your primary criterion for whether or not something's appropriate for the audience, if you think the audience is going to react to it negatively? I'm curious, because I've talked to a couple people who write things that they will not take to an audience because they are personally uncomfortable with reading it, they're uncomfortable with putting that out there, and it doesn't sound like that's your problem in this case. It's not that you were uncomfortable with the audience knowing about it, but you felt like reading it to the audience would, like, deflate them, depress them.
It's not so much about, like, I will be uncomfortable. I'm worried about their discomfort, mm-hmm. I guess, is what it is.
So is that one of the things that you find helpful about having a performance piece, is that you are thinking more about... You think more about your audience because you're performing?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay, well, we're going to pause right there for just a short break, but we'll be right back in just a second with the second half of the interview and a piece. Do you know what you're going to read for us?
Not yet. It'll come to me.
All right, we'll be back in just a second with Sarah Morgan.
Cross again.
And we're back. Okay, well, what have you got for us today? What are you reading for us?
It's a newer piece, and it was based off a quote by Chris McCandless, and I don't know who knows about him, if anyone's ever seen the movie Into the Wild that was based off of his life and how he wanted to just kind of, you know, get far away from society and go, you know, live in the woods, and he ended up, you know, starving, or actually he ate poisonous whatever, and he passed away out there. And
he was living like in a school bus.
Yeah,
I've heard about that book.
And he had wrote down shortly before he passed away, happiness is not real unless it is shared. And I thought that was really interesting, because here he wanted to get away from everything so he could experience like the ultimate freedom in his spirit, and at the end of it he's like, okay, I have this immense freedom and no one to share it with. So that's what the piece is kind of inspired by.
Okay. Yeah, go All for right.
The magnesium winter uncorks its dead face across the land. My body passes through it as a deserted water park, a lollipop left silent in a drain, pool of frozen red, plastic wrapper singed to my heel. And miles away from here, someone is embarrassed by a stain. A stain. Somewhere, a squirrel falls to its death. A child cannot curl into a small enough ball. A telemarketer struggles to smooth his accent. A woman stands naked in an unlocked dressing room. A pair of unworn sneakers are abandoned in a cemetery. It is not that I need love. It is that I have been trudging for years with damp socks balled in my pocket, unclaimed. Because my pocket has a hole doesn't mean it wasn't meant to contain such precious things. Somewhere, my mother is young. Standing at a kitchen counter, she jots on a paper towel and bags it with my lunch. In a cafeteria, I am reading it to myself. It says, remember, it is okay to go a little hungry, but never starve. Never starve. My cheeks, once meant to hold, are two pears thrown from a car window, the carcass. It was my fault. I lured it here. Come spoil with me, I cried. And the street signs stared on. The street signs will forget me. The passing cars will forget me, the axles spinning their exhausted mucus will forget me, the hot cedar air warbling from the tree line will forget me. Somewhere a light switch is confused with a garbage disposal, and I am startled. It is not that I am alone. It is this space. It is how the acoustics of this room have changed now that you're gone. It is the lake. When I lift my body from it, everything sinks just a little. It is not that I am alone. It is the unsteady boats on the lake, all touched by my absence. The fruit trees. The fruit trees will forget me, but your mouth, the nectar, a pit that remembers, 100 flies swarming.
Did the meaning of the narrator change through that? Like, was the I a different person occasionally?
I want to say no. Maybe be more specific. Where did you think it changed, I guess? It's not that I need love. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, just there seemed, at least to me listening to it, that there were a number of places throughout the piece where the narrator could have been a couple of different people. It could have been, towards the end, it sounded more like it was from the viewpoint of the person who had left,
mm-hmm.
Where earlier it was from the viewpoint of the person who was left.
That's interesting. I think my intention was for it to be, you know, consistent with one voice, you know, mm-hmm. speaking. But that's interesting that it came off as someone else.
And I'm curious, Is the narrator, is the first person in this, is that you?
It is.
It is you. Okay, so this is supposed to be a poem about yourself. I was curious because I could have. There were a couple of places where I wondered if it was a constructed narrative rather than an autobiographical narrative. So this is when did you write this? When was this written?
Oh, a little over a month ago.
Okay, so recently. Is this coming off of the Chicago winter then?
Yes.
Is this the poem you were talking about earlier? That about your departed lover?
No, it's not it.
Different one.
Yep.
Okay. Well, so how did Into the Wilderness sort of feed into this one? The idea that experiences are not meaningful unless shared?
That's the heart of the piece. That's what I want it to be, at least. I don't know. I guess, you know...
Because it seems like kind of a melancholy piece. It seems like the emotion that is shared or is not being shared is sort of an understanding of aloneness.
It is, and that's great. I think that's very true to this piece. I was thinking one day how there are things we are built for, things programmed into us that we still sometimes stray from. And I thought about, you know, a squirrel climbing a tree. And
it was a squirrel then, okay.
Yeah.
With the cheeks.
And
I wondered about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, I thought about a squirrel, like, climbing a tree and how somewhere on someday a squirrel made to climb a tree has fallen from it. And how sometimes we fail in the things that we were built for. And I thought that also kind of related to, like, you know, Chris McCandless going out into the wild and thinking, you know, this is what I want. But what he was, you know, what he was built for is to share the experience. It's kind of like the unavoidable truth. I also wanted to take a look at. Maybe that's confusing. When I write a lot of things into one piece, but hopefully, you know, there's one note that carries throughout. That's what I hope for.
Well, I think it's interesting because this feels like a very strongly city poem.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, I mean, you were starting off from a very non-city, an unurban, exurban sort of, you know, this Chris Candless fleeing into the wilderness and leaving mm-hmm. behind society, leaving behind cities and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the loneliness and the unsocialness, I guess, of the poem, the awareness that, you know, you are isolated, feels to me like the sort of loneliness that you only experience in a crowded environment, in some place where you are surrounded by people and by sort of acquaintances. And even like the squirrel thing, because the squirrel to me again just seems like more of an urban animal than a wild creature. They are built to sort of interlive with people.
Definitely. I don't know at this point. You can cut this out. I don't know. I think maybe I lost grip of your last question.
Oh, no, that's possible.
Okay.
Well, listening to it, the poem sounded sort of... It's a lonely piece. It's a poem about being alone and not being able to sort of, you know, connect with people. But at the same, it feels like it is set among people in a way that the quote, the source of the inspiration for the poem, is not set among people. Because you've got Chris Candless going off into the wilderness,
mm-hmm.
and this piece doesn't feel like it's that way. Is this a poem that is shaped by living in Chicago?
I don't think it's a poem shaped by living in Chicago, even if a lot of the examples seem influential of city living.
Well, walk me through how you sat down to write this then, when you had the idea. Or you came across the quote and you thought that'd be a good...
I wanted effective examples, but what I really wanted to say was, you know, all these, you know, it's not so much about all these, like, civilized things, you know, like, the street signs will forget me, the passing cars will forget me. It didn't matter if I'm placing it in the city or in the woods. What I wanted, you know, to ring true was the need to share yourself with someone else, and that's why
at things they won't forget you, people
right
won't forget
and
you
that's why at the end it's the fruit trees will forget me, but your mouth, the nectar, a pit that remembers, 100 flies swarming. I wanted it to come back to that.
It's an interesting sort of death imagery there too at the end with the flies, or is that meant to be more of life starting out of something? Or is it just like a summer image?
Let me think for a second. The fruit trees will forget me. In my head, and in my heart, I know what I mean by this, but I am struggling to articulate it. The fruit trees will forget me. It's about, you know, it's about, I don't know. We'll leave that one unanswered.
Fair enough. When you're writing, do you generally start with a source idea like that? Do you start with a quote? Do you start with a story? Do you start with a feeling that you want to capture? What starts a poem? What seeds a poem for you?
All those things you said, I try and think of, like, the heart of the piece, and, or maybe it'll be a quote. I seldom write, like, because of quotes in response to them, but sometimes, like I did here, but I try to have that main idea of what I want to say, but also, you know, there have been times where I've had the first line to a poem, and I'm like, okay, this is where it starts, and I've had no idea where it was gonna go, and sometimes it's come together and sometimes it hasn't, but sometimes I don't know where it's going, and at the end I'll ask myself, okay, is this confusing as shit, or is it worth salvaging? So I obviously try and have a point and a purpose, but sometimes I just see where it goes and let it flow from me and have faith in that.
I want to go back to something you said in the first half of the interview. We were talking about going in and seeing Derek Brown and not knowing that there had been poetry going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's still the case in most of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say all over the world because I haven't been all over the world, but certainly in America, I think the idea of poetry as a vibrant and vital part of the national arts scene is not understood or accepted particularly.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the poet laureate that spoke at the inauguration, for example, and the reaction to that one I've heard from people who are not involved in the poetry community is basically, who is this woman? Why is she talking? Can we change the channel now?
Yeah.
Sort of a thing. And so I'm curious, what do you think, what does poetry bring to the table that isn't being addressed by music, that isn't being addressed by theater, movies, television? Why poetry?
Why poetry? What a big question.
A little big,
you're right. It's sad to me. It's really, it's a little sad because, you know, poetry was one of, like, the first forms of art and entertainment way, way back, and it's just died out over time, at least, especially as far as performing it, and, you know, music sticks around, and all these other forms stick around. Why poetry? Go ahead.
I was just gonna say when you're selling your performances, when you're selling like the slam, how do you pitch that to people? What do you say to people to get them interested in the area? Because if you say, hey, come see this poetry, people are like, you know, I got hair to wash.
Well, you have to bribe them with sandwiches, obviously. Well, first of all, I think the idea of, you know, the slam is excellent for people who don't necessarily read a lot of poetry or know if they like it yet, because it puts it in a form where they're like, okay, this is a competition, and most people have some competitive bone in them or like to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's great. I think that introduces it to a lot of people. I think maybe it's not as popular as things like music because it's a little more challenging, you know? You can't just always bob your head to it. You have to actually listen. And sometimes that's, I don't want to say challenging. I mean, sometimes it's just boring to some people, I guess. I do have, you know, I think that there are certain ways to present poetry to make it more interesting to the person who is not, you know, the avid reader or the follower of poetry. I think Derek Brown has done wonderful things for poetry by, you know, incorporating music or incorporating humor. I think laughter speaks to everyone, and I try. It's hard to write funny, though. It's really, really difficult. But I try, and even if it's just in between poems during a set, like, connect to them and try and get them to laugh so they know, like, this is, you know, this is okay. Like, we can relax. We can enjoy this. This is not a class I'm teaching you. This is just, you know, something I'm sharing with you that I hope will resonate in you in some way. And it's a hit, and it's hit or miss, you know, but usually there's gonna always be, like, one person that was like, I'm really glad that I came. And that's, you know, that's enough.
Okay. Well, that is about all the time we have for this interview, unfortunately. Sarah Morgan, thank you for coming on the podcast. You have a website, or a MySpace page?
Yeah, I do.
And that's myspace.com/... Sarah Morgan, maybe? Morgan's Organs?
Sarah Morgan's Organs.
There we go. Okay. Anything else you want to push? Right Bloody Press publishes the book. The book is Animal Balladry?
Animal Ballistics.
Animal Ballistics, not Balladry.
That's okay. Anything else I want to push? I really like cockroaches as an insect. I think people should give them another chance. They're not bad. They mean well. Also, I think everyone should read more Jack Gilbert. I think he is brilliant and maybe my favorite poet. Ask again next week. So give cockroaches a chance. Read Jack Gilbert. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you for coming on the show, and we'll see you at the reading.
All right.
The Poetry Night podcast is directed by Robert Houston and is produced by yours truly, Andrew Cole, in Bellingham, Washington. Visit the Poetry Night website at www.poetrynight.org to subscribe to this podcast, or for a list of upcoming features and events, archived interviews and shows, and a library of poems from writers around the Northwest.